Audio interview with Melinda Leslie, recorded November 5th, 2010. I first met Melinda at the Laughlin UFO Conference in 2008. She was one of the people that attended the UFO abductee support group that was run by Leo Sprinkle. And Leo knew who she was by name, and it took me a little while to figure out that she was doing research. And she was very focused, and she had a really intense and deep knowledge of the subject. I was very impressed. And later, I heard her do an audio interview with Tim Binal of Binal of America, and I will recommend that interview highly. There is a link directly to his site, and there's a link directly to that interview on the show notes. Melinda has a very narrow focus in her line of research. She's been looking into the MILAB experience, and that stands for military abduction. Now, that term doesn't quite match what her research has uncovered, and we talk about that in the interview. This is a long interview, well over 2.5 hours. And I will also say it's very informative, with a lot of data. Melinda is well armed with research, and I trust her data. I trust her research. She's attempting to do something at a very high level, and I give her a lot of credit for that. She's very driven, and that comes across in this interview. The interview really needed to be as long as it is to cover correctly the depth of what Melinda has to share. I hope you get something out of this. I found it very important, the stuff we talked about. We cover some things that are out and out ignored by the UFO research community, and I just feel that this conversation is vital to better understanding this very mysterious phenomena. Please enjoy. Melinda Leslie, you're on the line, and I just wanted to give you a great big thank you for saying yes to this interview.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
You have become somewhat of an authority in this very curious field, this very funny community that is the UFO research community, and you have a specialization, and that's the military abduction phenomena.
Yes, it is.
And how long have you been looking into this?
Over 18 years now. I've been in ufology for about 22 years, maybe more like 21, but give or take. And then this subject more specifically for about 18. And, you know, right away I have a tendency to want to correct you, if I may, when you say military involvement, because I'm actually trying to steer it away from that very limited description, because it gives people a very incorrect perception that is not based upon the experiences or the evidence and what's happening to people. And it often gives people completely incorrect perception, which I'm sure we'll get into more as this goes on. But I actually have been calling it a covert ops involvement, because it's, yes, people see some military personnel, but there's this whole kind of intelligence community involvement, military-industrial complex community involvement, science and engineering community involvement. The term military, it becomes way too limiting. And so I think to call it covert ops is much more accurate, that there is a covert ops involvement with abductees, with ET abductees, extraterrestrial abductees, and involvement and the many ways that that plays out, everything from surveillance and monitoring and harassing kind of things to being re-abducted by the military and interrogated and having subsequent monitoring in your life. And, you know, it plays out in so many ways. But I think to say covert ops is much more accurate and encompassing of what's actually going on.
And Richard Dolan uses a sort of an umbrella term called the breakaway government as a way to try to describe this something that's happening well below the waterline in our somehow, whether it's private enterprises or whether it's actual government.
Well, that's interesting to redefine it, that, because the you know, breakaway government, if you will, has usually been referred to in alternative research in ufology and in paranormal research and everything, and in alternative political research, it's usually been referred to as the shadow government. I kind of understand why getting away from the term shadow government and into breakaway government may, much like calling this covert ops, it may be much more accurate in that slight difference, and I can see why he's doing that, and it gets away from a lot of assumptions about shadow government. The shadow government also, you would think it's shadowing, you know, shadowing our government. And it may be separate in so many ways that it's actually a breakaway separate item as opposed to something shadowing, you know. So it may actually be more accurate, just like calling this covert ops, when this is really a covert ops involvement as opposed to just military. You know, so it's much more accurate.
Yes, very much so. And I think that I respect your dedication to accurate vocabulary, because...
Well, it's more about not giving people an incorrect picture, because I get it all the time where a lot of people are like, oh, so you're saying there's no ET abductions, it's all the military. And it's like, no, my research completely puts that to bed. That's not even an option. I mean, it's because these people are having ET experiences that there's any interest in them whatsoever. And so it's like, it's not a military in lieu of ET thesis at all. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons too, is because it's over the years, the term military involvement, which is actually a term was coined by researcher Helmut Lammert called MILAB. And so many people still refer to it as MILAB, but there's two things wrong with that. One is the overemphasis on it being military, and the second is that it's about the military abducting people, when a lot of it is about harassment, surveillance, and monitoring, and may have nothing to do with someone actually getting picked up. Yes, some people are picked up too, but if they're picked up by guys in suits, then how do you say it's the military? You know, so that kind of thing. So again, it puts too much emphasis on it being military, and it puts too much emphasis on the abduction or what I call the re-abduction scenario, where a person is an ET abductee and then they're re-abducted by human agencies. Instead of calling it MILAB as an acronym, I've been calling it REA, meaning it's a play on words that I intended. One is re-abduction, R-E-A-B, you know, for re-abduction, and also R period E period AB for reverse engineered abductees, which gets into the reasons why it's happening. It's all about why it's happening. And, but again, you know, I think the term MILAB is so limiting. It gives people a misperception. So many people jump to a conclusion that you're talking, you know, government and military and not in ET involvement. And my research is 100% based upon any of this is happening because the person has had ET experiences. And that is their interest in the abductees is because they are reverse engineering the abductees. And so, you know, I want to make that very clear to people. This is happening because these people are having ET experiences. Now, however you want to define ET experiences, that's a different ball game. But I'm not saying, you know, it doesn't matter how you define that. That's possibly a variety of things that equals an ET experience, but that someone has had physical experiences with something very other that is not human, that they then have an interest bestowed on them by human agencies because they've had those experiences with something very other.
And how does the human agencies, which is a nice catchphrase, just to sort of, you know, to say mm-hmm. that it's not coming from these extraterrestrial or extra-dimensional entities.
Well, and I think call it covert ops, because I think that it is covert, it is operations, it involves a variety of agencies. And so you can call the people involved the agents, I guess, you know, but collectively they're covert ops, because it is, yes, it involves some military, yes, it involves some science and engineering, yes, it involves some intelligence people, you know, so all together they're under a covert ops or black ops umbrella, part of the functioning working arm of the breakaway government. There you go, putting my research and riches together.
Good, good. And how, now this is something that over the years I've read, well back into the 90s, I read Katrina Wilson's book, I read Leah Haley's book, I read, there's a book called The Exiles by a woman named Mia Adams, which I thought was very interesting.
These are all cases of mine, every single one of those.
And I read, what's her name, the woman that wrote Taken, and she wrote Into the Fringe? Oh, Carla Turner.
Oh, yeah,
yes.
Carla Turner.
And I read her books, and this was well before, this was still in the 90s when I was reading all these books. And so I feel like I have a pretty good insight into the claims of people who are sharing this experience. And obviously those experiences, those books that I'm quoting from or that I'm referencing go back over a decade. And
And I call all these people cases of mine, and I want to clarify to people what I mean by cases. I am not a therapist of any type. I'm not a hypnotherapist. I do not do hypnosis on people. I am not licensed or qualified in any or trained in any form of clinical therapy. I am just a researcher, an investigator, and an experiencer. I'm someone who's had it happen myself, which caused me to start kind of self-investigating what had happened to me, led me to talking to other people who had also had this happen, as you just said, reading those books, meeting those individuals, talking to them in depth, meeting other cases, and, you know, voila, it's 18 years later, you know, and it's never stopped. But I've kind of become the last person standing, if you will, not completely, but to some degree in ufology and in abduction research, as someone who's willing to focus on this, is out there talking and communicating and being interviewed about it, and occasionally writing some things about it. And some of those people have either pulled out of the field. In the case of Carla, unfortunately, she passed away. But, you know, some people have either passed away or pulled out, or you know, at one time we had Austrian researcher by the name of Helmut Lammer from Austria, and he wrote a book called My Labs. He was the person that coined that term and came up with the acronym. And but for professional reasons, he pulled out of the field. I'm happy to say that Kay Wilson is back and is being more active and currently writing, and I'm so glad. Leah surfaces from time to time. Another individual, Kim Carlsberg, who surfaces from time to time. People kind of pulled out or laid low in the field, and I was left kind of by default being the last person standing. But that's all right, because and now I've taken a step further and taken it on as a research project, and really making a point to get the word out and educate other people about it. So I've accepted that role because someone needs to be doing it. And anyways, self-appointed.
Well, good for you. No, because this is very interesting, because like, I don't want to go down this road. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, it's scary, it's unbelievable, it the implications are kind of so grim that I don't even want to confront them.
Well, and I try to diffuse all that and have people look at it from a really logical, pragmatic, this makes sense, it has everything to do with the reality of this kind of avenue, because the more I've looked at it, it's just so pragmatic. It makes so much sense. It's such a logical continuation. Once you understand the nature of the cover-up, once you understand how many abduction cases there are, ET abduction cases, you realize abductions, and we can get more into this, but just loosely stated, that abductions became a matter of national security because of how many there are, that the those involved in the managing, so when you say those conducting the cover-up, if you will, it's not really that they're trying to cover anything up. It's really that they're trying to manage a subject, okay? And that's very compartmentalized. So, but at the level that you have crash retrievals, retrievals of craft and body, reverse engineering programs to develop the technology, at that level, somewhere along the way, and fairly long ago, actually, it's not recent, but somewhere long ago, back in the 40s and 50s, somebody realized that abductees were another source of information and proceeded to monitor them, surveillance them, re-abduct them, interrogate them, because they were another source of information. And it's part of their managing of the subject is managing what's going on in abduction, in abduction research, in abductees who are public, and as well as using them for a source of information for their technology development programs. And so it's like it's just such a logical extension of the entire management project that it diffuses it from being all those things. And the only implications are, oh my God, abductions are real. Okay, yeah, and? You know, ET abductions are real, you know, yeah, okay. And gosh, there really is development of technology and there really is this management of the whole ET equation going on by covert groups, yeah, and? So, doesn't the rest of ufology point to those things too? So it doesn't need to be dark or scary, it just needs to be something that makes sense. Now, is there some abuses and criminal activity involved in how they're managing these abductees, in their surveilling them and harassing them and re-abducting them? Yeah, it's criminal. But hello, a lot of how they manage this, the fact that they're managing this subject and keeping it from people, the fact that there's a policy of non-disclosure is criminal, you know? And that's part of the reasons why it continues, because they know it's criminal and they know, oh my God, when disclosure happens, you know, pardon my Linus, but the shit's going to hit the fan, you know. And so that's part of the, you know, it's a catch-22, you know. They've backed themselves into a corner, this is just such a logical part of the process that I think people can say, okay, it's not all that scary. Yes, the ultimate thing, and I think this is what really bothers people, is it means not only are ET abductions absolutely real, they're happening in a large way, and the fact that there's a covert involvement speaks to the reality of it. And I think that's the part that even ufology, you know, I always say, you know, in my lectures and stuff, that they put abductions, you know, on the back burner, and that where the, you know, the, I would say, pardon my language again, but the bastard step is abductions. And it's like, that's a shame that, it's like people haven't been able to wrap their head around, well, how does this fit? Never mind on the covert op, to the covert ops guys, they completely get it. It's ufology that doesn't get it. The covert ops guys get it. Now, granted, I'm not making apologies for them. What they're doing is wrong, how they're handling it. They're abusing people. They're mistreating people. There's all sorts of experimentation stuff going on. And it's almost too mild to say that it's criminal. I mean, it's wrong on so many levels. So no one say, well, she's apologizing for it. But I understand why. I understand where it fits. And that's the part I'm trying to articulate to people so that the comments you just made, as someone who has read about this and is educated, sees how it fits and doesn't see it as something spooky, but see it as a form of confirmation and validation to the reality of an ET presence, of the fact that they're hardware and craft, that there's technology to it. You know, this is extreme confirmation and validation to all that. And I'll get off my pulpit.
No, that's your pulpit was well said. And when I say it's scary, I mean, the implications of all of this, are scary.
Implications are it's real, but that doesn't need to be scary. It's like, okay, you know, is it really that scary that there are beings in other planets other than Earth or in other dimensions other than this third dimension? You know, no, that's not scary. That's just reality. And it doesn't need to be scary. It needs it. It doesn't. In fact, it, we should move beyond it being scary to embracing that there is a reality, that there are other presences, and that consciousness and life and the universe is much more incredible, much more beautiful, much more complex. You know, that there is life everywhere. That needs to be embraced, not. It shouldn't be a fearful thing. I understand, though, and I understand why people have that reaction. And it's overcoming. And that's, people have to realize, too, the fear is because you've been told to be fearful. There's been an intense programming going on your whole life that has taught you to fear something you should not fear, you know, and that it's just reality. I mean, I don't think we ever we need to fear things that aren't real, like a government out of control. I mean, don't get me started with politics or, you know, economy. And, you know, there are a lot of things that are controlling our lives that aren't based on reality. I think it's time we start embracing that things that are real. And if it means life in other places and other dimensions and our spirituality and being more than our physical bodies and all these things that that you learn of and understand when you start looking at, you know, ufology, you know, it's like these are the things that are real, you know? So, yeah, okay, there are other entities out there. There's other realms. There's other, you know, there's other planets. There's other dimensions. Yeah, okay, yeah, you know. But I understand. I understand there's a lot of programming to overcome, and a person's knee-jerk reaction is one of fear, you know, because there's been a lot of stuff shoved down your throat and shoved down your brain, you know, to make you perceive it a certain way. So
as I proceed forward in this, you know, we've talked about this before the interview started, where I shared some of my experiences, mm-hmm. and it has been very challenging for me to go down this road, and I have a tough time defining it. You had an easier time defining it than I did, and I'm my own worst critic. I'm the person I'm most skeptical is myself. And mm-hmm. but one of the things that's happened is I've made a real effort to reaching out, contacting people, talking to people who claim to have had experiences that involve whether it's abduction or contact or you know, whatever vocabulary word you want to use. And I've been hearing these military stories, and these stories, when heard first person, you know, when it sits across from me and, you know, the tears well up in their eyes and they share these stories, mm-hmm. you know, something's going on that is deeply invasive to the individual.
Oh,
sure. Yeah. And I think we can, you know, we both can agree on that. And it makes me, you know, there's a sympathetic side to me that I just want to make sure that like I'm telling the story correctly in a way. It seems like there's a rabbit hole where there's so much disinformation and so much strangeness out there that it's very easy to try to look into this and then just get dragged into some corner with some conspiracy theories that, you know, even by my very liberal standards of what defines that are pretty crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's it, is realizing how out of control the situation is, that there is a breakaway government and that we let that happen on our watch, you know. We as a individually and as a community and as a nation and as a world, because it's also a worldwide problem. It's not just U.S. And so it's the realization of how big the problem is and how deep the lies go, you know. And so these, when people have these experiences and they share that emotion, it's because that sense of betrayal and that learning curve for them individually through that process is so intense. And then the rather overwhelming validation that therefore their ET experiences are real. And so when you listen to someone who's sharing their experience of this, to whatever degree they've had it, and, you know, but especially if they've had it fairly intensely, in fact, if they've had the re-abduction scenario where they've been taken by military, or taken by ETs, and then seen military and covert ops and scientists and, you know, people involved, taken to a military base or underground. If someone's had a fairly intense, you know, experience of that, you're getting their recall of, I mean, if you think about it too, kind of taking a healthy step backwards, if anything like that happened to you in life for any reason, I mean, again, that would be a serious criminal involvement. There are government abductions that happen. I mean, you know, for political reasons.
Sure, sure.
And private organization abductions and private individual abductions. And so whenever you get that level of abuse and obtrusiveness and intrusiveness or whatever from other people, you know, it's highly criminal, you know, in regards to your civil rights. It's damaging physically, emotionally, and mentally, you know, so you have that whole aspect of this, of these experiences, that would apply to any other situation in life where this were to happen. But then you've got this added element of it's happening in relationship to their ET experiences or for that reason. So, you know, it's adding insult to injury or damage, or, you know, damaged injury, in that first the person has the ET abduction, usually unwanted, usually obtrusive in itself. In a strange way, many abductees, because of the otherworldly nature of it, the paranormal nature of it, that helps an abductee in many ways cope with it. There's a way to kind of brush it under the rug, deny it, or put it in a certain category of a paranormal experience. So sometimes that high strangeness of those experiences helps abductees cope with it, because you're able to separate it as something different than your everyday reality, something different than your life. And that may not be the correct response, but it is a coping mechanism. And seeing it as something paranormal, seeing it as something weird, seeing it as something dreamlike, okay, that helps the abductee live their life. As you well know with your own experience.
Yeah, I was going to interject. Yeah,
compartmentalizing and denying it. Have you dealt with your own experiences? No, I think you'd be the first to admit that. But you've been able to go on with life because you were able to say, well, that was something other. And you're able to go into that denial or go into that way that separates it as that something paranormal, that something else. And you're able to live your life. But what happens then with these covert ops experiences is that threshold is crossed, you know, because suddenly when you have an experience with humans and taken in a human way, when I say taken in a human way, you might be thrown in a car or van or drugged or, you know, stopped at the side of the road, escorted away, ridden on a Jeep, on a helicopter, on a plane, on a human-built UFO. We can get to that later, but, you know, human-built craft. Whatever it might be, it seems to be a very human process. You're taken to usually to a military base or a science facility. It looks human. You see that there's lighting fixtures and linoleum floors and tiles and drop ceilings and fluorescent light fixtures and handles on doors and security windows and security electronic stuff. And, you know, it's just everything about it is human, you know, for the most part. I mean, there are combined experiences. We'll talk about that in a minute. But when it's predominantly a human thing, you know, suddenly it's like all that ability to push it aside and say, this is something paranormal, this is something other, it becomes much harder to deny. And what I end up hearing, and I've heard this from everyone I've talked to about their experiences, across the board, unanimously, without my even having to ask them, all abductees say, my military or my covert ops experiences were a lot worse than my ET ones. Now, sometimes it's not so much that they've been that badly mishandled. Sometimes they have. Sometimes it's directly that, you know, they've been mishandled and hurt, you know, physically or something. But sometimes it's not even so much that. It's just the in your face, oh my God, this is human, and how dare they? How dare they? You know, that feeling that people have, and you cannot deny it and compartmentalize it like you can an ET experience. And then they realize the reason it's happening is because of their ET experiences. Suddenly it takes what they've been able to shove aside and compartmentalize and deny and brings it to the forefront. So coming to terms with your covert ops experiences makes you have to come to terms with, oh my God, my ET experiences are real, when maybe you hadn't done that before. So it really puts it in people's face. And a lot of abductees get quite overwhelmed by it and pull away and drop out of the field. You know, if they started to go public or started to work with therapists and stuff, or they decide, I'm just not going to talk about this part. I'll talk about my ET part. And that's partially to blame for ufology and particularly the abduction research community of not really embracing this, that people are not comfortable talking about this with the researchers. That's changing. It's changing. People are coming around. Researchers are being more open to it. But, you know, that change is rather recent. Thank God there are exceptions. I mean, there's always exceptions. And there are certainly people who have researchers in abduction researchers who have embraced this, worked with it, worked with people. Certainly, like you mentioned, Carla Turner, looking at it early on, realizing it happened to her and her family and her husband, realizing what's happening to her cases, then writing about it and being very, you know, open to it. Leo Sprinkle has had cases of it, is pretty open to it. John Carpenter has always had cases and been pretty open to it. But you know, all in all, it's like to get the other researchers to say, okay, this exists, and to see it for what it is. But I understand it makes them uncomfortable. Like you said, it makes you uncomfortable. There's a in-your-face, you know, deal with reality part of it that you know, even the researchers who work with abductees, I think, are able to in some way disconnect and disassociate, like the abductees are, who are able to say, well, this is something else, this is something paranormal, you know, as opposed to, you know, maybe that's not fair. That's not fair, but I understand, and they're coming around to realizing that these cases are there, that people have this covert ops part. And another thing is that there's not as much of it as the ET stuff. I mean, there's not as many abductees having the covert ops as there are ET abductees. And usually it's a little further down the road. Someone is having ET experiences for a while before they have this part happen. It's usually, you know, down the road in their experiences. So a lot of times they've worked only in the beginning with someone like yourself, you know, who's maybe had some regressions or something. Someone who works initially with an abduction researcher, and either this hasn't started happening for them yet, or they've repressed it, or if they have some few clues or maybe beginnings of some a little mild harassment or, you know, surveillance stuff happen. And there's no reason to bring that up if they're starting with abduction 101 with a regression therapist. There'd be no reason to get into this. It's usually the people, again, who are further down the road, who've done more self-exploration to get into looking at these experiences. Or, again, it's usually an abductee down the road who's even had these kinds of experiences.
And how this covert ops group, how do they find the abductees?
Ah.
I mean, in one sense, all they need to do is tap a few phones, right? So they check the emails of like the abduction researchers, and they probably come up with a wealth of information.
Although I don't really think they're getting it from the abduction researchers. I haven't come across anything in my research to suggest that. If anything, once you start really working with a researcher, they tend to leave you alone. If anything, there's evidence for the opposite. but it one thing I have come, there's a number of things. And through over the years, I've come across different things, and I focused on this is how they know, or this is how they know, or this is how they know. So one thing that's happened in the last 2 years that I've become more aware of that I think plays a major factor is it tends to be multi-generational, just like ET abductions. For those listening to this who aren't aware, ET abductions are multi-generational. They happen in families. Not in every case by any means, but it's just such a high degree. And as abduction has become more widely talked about, more known in ufology, abductees are getting older, abductees have family, have kids, then they realize their kids are having these experiences. A lot of abductees have realized this happened to their parents. A lot of adult abductees that have this happen go back and get regression and recall experiences and then recall when their children were little, their children were also involved, or, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, I'm aware now of a couple of cases in ET abduction where it goes back as much as five generations in a family. I'm familiar with at least two cases that go back five generations. Four generations is very common. You have an abductee, you have their kids, you have their parents, you have the grandparents. That's very common. So five generations would be great-grandparents. And I'm aware of two cases going back to, like, the 1800s with great-grandparents involved. But three generations is very common, and four generations is becoming somewhat more common. And this has been known now for quite a while in abduction research that it tends to run in families this way. Well, so too does, and I'm learning this more and more and getting more cases, that the covert ops involvement tends to run in families. So if there's a, in other words, you know, you might have harassment and surveillance and you learn your parents did too, or your grandparents did, or someone was involved in aerospace, or, you know, there's these other connections that come up too with regarding family backgrounds. And so there's a whole bunch of crossover that suggests to me, well, this also is happening in families. So if you're somebody with this involvement could go back in your family. And because I do have some cases of that. Now, many, many years ago, I realized that I became friends with Ron Regehr, a researcher who helped design the DSP spy satellite, and more specifically, its information retrieval system. And he wrote some articles for the MUFON Journal about how the DSP spy satellite was occasionally tracking UFOs. And he wrote some article called the, you know, what, $2 million or $20 million or whatever it was, you know, UFO detector or whatever, I forget what it was called. But it was about how the spy satellite was occasionally picking up what the government officially called fast walkers, which were these craft or objects seemingly under intelligent control coming in from deep space and entering into our atmosphere. And it was tracking these. And then he did some research to learn of other satellites doing this. Well, from this little bit of research, you start to learn of satellites doing this, and then as soon as you start to research or look into satellites, you know, it becomes pretty clear that that they probably have more than a few satellites that are up there detecting UFOs. First off, satellites that are doing it by chance. In other words, they're designed for other purposes. They just happen to be catching these things, not to mention the amount of satellites that they have up there specifically to catch these things, specifically up there monitoring what's coming and going. And I can't say for sure how much of that there is, other than I think it's safe to say that there is, and there's probably a lot. And then also, when you start to look into the space shuttle missions, and of which there's many space shuttle missions now, there's three or four that are the most famous, but there's actually quite a few that have tracked UFOs and filmed them, and the space station, and, you know, so you start to look at the data and you go, you know what, I think they're tracking these things coming and going a lot better than even ufology has given them credit for. In other words, I think that they have devices specifically for tracking stuff coming and going. And so to figure out that craft are continually going to an area, and then the next logical step would be to do what you just said, which is monitor the phones, monitor the email, monitor the websites, you know, to know what kind of communication is going on about experiences. And if they have craft continually coming and going from a particular area, then probably that craft is coming and going. If someone's having a lot of abductions and there's a lot of craft coming and going, you know, so they, and also a part of this we haven't talked much about, I mentioned only briefly earlier, was the fact that a lot of these experiences involve covert ops and ET working together. And when people see ET and human personnel in the same environment, and a lot of these experiences are where the abductee can also be taken by ETs, in other words, predominantly an alien abduction experience, but at one point handed over to human personnel. Researcher Joe Mentaldo calls it the handoff. So a lot of abductees have the handoff, where they have what seems in the beginning to be an ET experience, but at some point there's either military personnel also involved or they're literally handed over to them. And
that, this gets, now can you just fill that in a little bit, because that this is very strange.
But before we go off on that tangent, we go off on that, I want to go back to, that's another way they might know. I'm not so certain that in some cases the ETs aren't telling them who they're involved with. In one of my own experiences that involved ETs and humans together, but it was specifically a gynecological procedure, and I believe the ETs allowed the humans to do this, that they allowed them to do it, and then at the end of the experience, I was actually double-checked and somewhat cleaned up, although the humans did a pretty good job, so the ETs just kind of checked me over before bringing me back. And so in that experience, it was predominantly human experience, but at the end, it involved some ETs. And but I'm just saying that in some cases, the ETs may be informing them about you. So if first off, it could be in the genealogy of your family. It could be another thing that comes up in the people that have the covert ops experiences is a lot of times they have family members in high levels of defense intelligence positions, aerospace positions, NASA positions, these kinds of things that run in families, connections to black ops programs and stuff like that. So there's these family connections to the technology, engineering, space, and covert worlds. And then you have those same families tend to be the ones that also have the covert ops involvement and abduction involvement in their families, or the ET abduction, you know, people realize this other stuff goes back in their families. And so you have this crossover. So given all this, there's a lot of ways they could know. They're monitoring your family over a period of time, the kids, the grandkids, because of some past member's involvement. They're monitoring craft coming and going, so they know if abductions are continually happening in a place. They then might be monitoring the phones in that location to see if you're talking about it. I mean, and then they have, you know, many ways of monitoring things coming and going, everything from space shuttle related stuff to all the various satellites and other tracking devices that may be up there. You know, so suddenly it's like, oh, you know, if they want to find out who the abductees are, they can find out. And not to mention if an abductee goes public, like you said, starts talking to a therapist, this kind of thing. So given all these factors, I think there's a lot of ways they may find out who has this happen.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm just thinking of it shows up in the Allagash book that Raymond Fowler wrote. This is going back over 10 years ago, where there's some nefarious stuff that's hinted at, that they don't really go down that avenue very much, but they certainly talk about, you know, odd cars being parked in front of their homes and such.
Yeah, I once asked, was it Jim Weiner, about it briefly. He's one of those guys.
Mm-hmm. I've met Jim, yeah.
Yeah, and... And he said yes. And subsequently, most of the major cases, this is another thing I've learned, in fact, off the top of my head, all but one major abduction research case has had this kind of stuff happen.
And what's the one that hasn't?
To my knowledge, I'm not aware of anything happening with Travis.
Okay.
Or Mike Rogers or any of the guys. But I'm not sure, and I'd have to talk to them more about it. But I've not heard of anything yet. I wouldn't be surprised, but I haven't heard of anything. But, for instance, the Allagash case certainly had this happen and had it happen subsequently. Most of the other well-known cases, I mean, you could start throwing out cases, and I could probably give you examples of where this has creeped up in their case, including the Hills, who had it actually pretty extensively. I've had some conversations with Kathleen Martin, Betty's niece, who wrote a book, whatever that was, about 2 years ago with Stan Freeman,
yeah.
Captured, and in Captured. But I talked to her, and the Hills had a lot of this subsequently, and including a particular time when they think Barney was abducted by humans, you know, abducted by the military, and some other harassment surveillance stuff, and you know, but she said yes, they had lots of this subsequent to their, you know, initial experience, and so the Hills are a MyLab case, you know, but most of the major cases are, and that's one thing I've learned. It's like, okay, you know, I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised at all if any case ends up having this happen. And I've even worked with some. Now, of course, I know ET cases where this hasn't happened. Of course, it's luckily it's not. It's still a rather small percentage of cases overall. Although, as you and I recently discussed on the phone, and any listener right now might find interesting is Les Velez, who heads up with June Steiner, a group called Opus up in the Bay Area, an abductee, you know, investigation, research, and support organization. Opus is OPUS, which is Organization for Paranormal Understanding and Support. And I think they have about, I don't know, like 500 members or something. And they actually got headed up, or not headed up, but chosen to head up a research project for MUFON on abductions, like a new abduction study being funded by MUFON, which Les and his team, to my understanding, have headed up. I don't know completely all the findings. I'm starting to hear some things about it. I think they're just starting to kind of publish all the results and stuff. But one thing he did is they wanted to look at the amount of covert stuff for some of these cases, and I've yet to find the full results of that. But one thing he did early on is he asked their own, like, online support group and regular members, and he put out a question, and he didn't ask about harassment, surveillance, or anything. He got right to the nitty-gritty and said, how many people see military personnel in your experience? And he said about half the people responding said they have.
And that shocks me. That's a much higher number than I would have guessed.
Yeah, exactly. And even me. I would have placed this at, well, it breaks down different ways. Like, and again, I haven't really looked at numbers, so I can't say with any definitive, you know, but just, you know, theoretically or speculation. I'm getting tongue-tied. Is you know, like harassment and surveillance, I might have put it half of the cases as having harassment surveillance. But as far as the reabduction, seeing military or human personnel in your experiences, I would have put that at like 2% of abduction. Certainly not more than 10%. Here in his, you know, in his impromptu informal survey, and I'd have to talk to him a little bit more about the parameters of how it was asked and how many people were asked and whatever. And whether it's 50% of his total membership or 50% of just the respondents, because that would have to be factored in. But even at 50% of just the respondents to the question, in other words, people who bothered to respond, and I thought, well, there might be a slight increase because those who bothered to have military are going to be quicker to respond than anyone who just had EP who may not be as quick to respond. But it's still a high number. And I had brought up the question of covert ops involvement in a couple of support group situations over the last 2 years at a couple of conferences and some private groups and stuff that I went to. And it was constantly coming up, like, you know, if there were 20 or 30 people present, you know, 8 or 10 had covert ops involvement. And that was pretty high, because that would mean, you know, close to a third, or if not more, a third to almost half of the people present. And so, and again, I count the harassment surveillance part. Again, the re-abduction stuff, I would have said was, you know, half of those people had it, you know. So, but it also seems that the number's increasing. So somebody would have to do a large abduction study and to really come up with some definitive numbers. The person who's kind of come the closest to that, and even with what he's done, it's kind of loose, but Joe Montaldo of the ICAR organization, mm-hmm. International Community for Alien Research, he says, you know, as far as in their files, they have over almost 9,000 ET abduction cases. Officially means investigated or interviewed to some degree by members of his organization. You know, so these are official records. They have about, he actually gave me a number of 8,800 ET abduction cases in their files. He says he looked at those, and he had his researchers look at them to kind of ballpark how many people had harassment surveillance. He said there were about 800 cases of harassment surveillance, about 450 cases of re-abduction, in other words, with a military presence, and about 75 of those 450 cases were international, involving international, either people had it happen while traveling or people in other countries, that kind of thing. But so there are some interesting numbers, and so that ends up being 10, you know, that breaks down to what, 10%, 5%, you know, that kind of thing. So harassment surveillance was about 10% of his cases, and about half of those had a military presence, but half of those, I guess, would equal, I guess, 5% of his cases overall. So I think that's probably about where the numbers are at. That, to me, seems pretty realistic. It may have been somewhat askew in Opus's asking of that question if it wasn't from their total membership, but of just the people who respond, because, of course, the people who've had the, when you're asked that and you're sent that in, they were sent an email, you know, question, that the people with the military experiences were going to be much more likely to respond. So I would have to ask less, and I guess I should. How many of your total members said yes? In other words, not of how many people responded. If it's half the people responded, was it half the membership? And that, I need to clarify that with them. It's probably not half the membership, but still, it would be. It still is high. So it's a big deal. It's a big deal, and the abduction research community needs to look at it even more and realize it's happening in their cases. I'm constantly getting the other researchers to realize how many cases of this they have and how it's coming up, and so, you know, I'm getting them to go, wow, okay, I do have more of this, and this has come up in my cases.
And now, if people see a military person in a craft, I mean, could that be a screen memory, the same way as, I mean, I've heard people say they see Jesus in among with the gray aliens.
Sure. Well, yes, and it could be in some circumstances, but I tend to focus on the cases that are fairly clear that they're in a human environment. There's usually much more involvement. It's not just you're just seeing him. Some cases where people just say, "I saw a military guy and he was out of place and I don't know why he was there." But those are pretty rare. Usually there's an involvement with the covert personnel. Usually there's quite a bit of interaction and involvement and communication,
Okay.
and there's usually a purpose to their being there. If anything, it tends to be where if people are claiming at all that there's a military presence, it tends to be, or a human presence, it tends to be more that than ET. It tends to be, if anything, they see the ET and the ET is out of place. But in some cases, the ETs are also interactive, so they're not out of place. So I had the few cases that were like, yes, I was taken by the military, I was taken to an underground base, and I'm in this room, and they're questioning me, and they bring an ET in the room, and this guy's there, and he's there for a while, and then he leaves, and I don't know if that was real, or, you know. So I have those cases, or I have the people say, you know, I was on the examination table, and it was with people, and I was in the base, in the military hospital, blah, blah, blah. And the guys were wearing lab outfits and surgical smocks or whatever, and all of a sudden, you know, all of a sudden there's an ET or two ETs there, and they're leaning over me, and they're checking me out, you know, kind of thing. So those are the cases with minimal involvement. But there are cases that have more, you know, like even in my own experience where at the end I thought I was having a completely human experience. At the very end, I was handed over to ETs, who then took me into a room, examined me, checked some stuff out. I'm not sure what all they did to me, but it seemed like they were just checking out what all was done and making sure I was in good shape. But it was kind of weird because it was kind of like a little ET experience on top of the fact that I just had this predominantly human one. And a lot of abductees, you know, say, well, I was taken by ETs and I'm taken to an underground base, but at one point we're met in the hallway by these guys in camouflage, or these guys in tan short sleeve uniforms, or guys in dark jumpsuits, or, you know, or guys in lab coats or some combination thereof. And then those guys escorted me away and I never saw the ETs again, you know. There's also the people with that experience, and it can be a mix. Now, granted, you know, amongst these covert ops experiences, to see ETs and humans together is rarer, but there are, you know, multiple accounts of it, and so it's you're more likely to just have a human ex you're more likely to have either an ET experience or a human experience, and not a combined. But you know, a lot of people do have combined, and they see them together. So that's and a lot of those books you mentioned earlier are people who've written about those experiences where they've seen both together.
Yes. Yes. Hey, so is there any sort of checklist as far as what takes place when people claim being followed, or the overt harassment that takes place?
Well, there's a standard kind of set of things that happen to people. Not that there's a checklist, like, you know, well, okay, I guess there is. It's a checklist of the kind of things that happen, and usually when I talk to someone who has this happening, I try to get right away to understanding how much has happened with them or how little. But I'll go through a quick list. I have kind of a bulleted list here of kind of the things that happen, and kind of in the order. Like, it tends to start out low grade and then build to more stuff. So someone could have any point along this list and then all of a sudden have it fall off and they don't have the rest of the list, you know. So someone might only have the first thing on the list, or the first three things, or the first five things, or, you know. So but here's kind of the bulleted list I have of things that happen is It may start off with being watched or being followed, and this could happen at home or your workplace or traveling, you know, but you find yourself under surveillance in some form. You can have black helicopter surveillance or harassment. These are unmarked, usually reported as being black or dark in color helicopters. And they're not, you know, like just one flying by. People call me, oh, I saw one. I'm like, you know, I wouldn't necessarily count that. It has to, if it's returning periodically, circling repeatedly, if it's flying illegally low, you know, I mean, you know if you're being harassed or surveillance. It's like circling. It's very low. It's menacing. It's, you know, it's clear that it's following you, or it's clear that it's diving over your house or, you know, wherever. Then there's threats can be made to the abductee, to their family or friends. And these can be pretty low grade and where you're kind of like going, well, that's weird. What was that? Or they can be really confrontational. But there can be, these can be made in person or over the phone or through emails or, you know, can be a variety of things. Then there's phone interruptions and harassing, intimidating, or even threatening phone calls. These can vary from just every time you talk to another researcher or another abductee on the phone, you find that you have minor phone interruptions and clicks and stuff, but it doesn't happen during any other phone calls. It only happens when you're talking about the subjects. You know, it seems to be very subject-specific, meaning you're talking about something regarding UFOs or ETs or, you know, something along those lines. It can become even to the point of harassing and intimidating phone calls, where you have phone calls from people. There's all sorts of different accounts of the way that this has played out. There can be electronic phone calls, electronic voices. There can be threats and warnings. There all sorts of things. There can be phone messages and things that break in the middle of your conversation with someone else. It can be really subtle or it can be really blatant and everything in between. And then there's email and snail mail tampering. You can have your email tampered with. You mail something to some researchers. They get it, but when they get it, they say, you know you sent five things in the envelope and they only get two or three of the things you sent. Or someone could send you some stuff and you only get part of what they sent you. Or it looks like the it's been tampered with. Or there's a note written in there. So, you know, there can be many, many ways that this is surfaced as far as mail tampering.
Yeah, and I'm going to interject here just for a second. And, I mean, with all the technology we have, I mean, I'm certainly we know how to open an envelope and close it without anyone knowing.
Well, not always. Not always. Sometimes someone can tell. And sometimes they're blatant. Sometimes they've been taped up.
Yeah, blatant aspect is seems to be what's showing up here.
Well, that's the harassment.
Yeah.
Thing. They're not just monitoring you, they're letting you know. They're specifically letting you know. And that's meant to be harassing and intimidating when they do stuff like that. But sometimes it's very blatant. I mean, if you are certain you sent a certain amount of things to a researcher or somebody sent stuff to you, and when you get it, it's not all there. You know, I mean, that's pretty blatant. And email, you know, email stuff, and also computer hacking. You could... I know of a couple cases where people had certain files and certain things messed with on their computer. It's usually not everything. It's usually, again, very subject-specific. This tends to happen to people who've taken a lot of photographs, that they'll notice that their computer's been tampered with. Maybe some of those photos or file folders of photos have been taken. Or you know, sometimes an abductee has come home from being away. No one's been in the home. Maybe they've even been out of town or they've been at work all day. They come home, and the computer's on, and there's something left on the screen for them to see, you know, that kind of thing. So, again, it can be subtle or it can be pretty blatant. Then there's in-person face-to-face confrontations and warnings. This can be where you can be approached in public. I know people who've been approached where they work. I know people that have been approached privately or somewhat privately, but in a public setting. They can be confrontations. They can be warnings. They can be, we're watching you. They can be telling you, not to go public, or, you know, whatever. All sorts of combination of these. And, of course, like Men in Black experiences as well. And then there's illegal break-ins to property, homes and, you know, homes, houses, offices, vehicles that have been broken into. There's underground bases visited with advanced technology seen, and this is where you are now, this is, you know, stepped up now to where you're being taken, whether it's by humans or ETs, and quite often it involves going to an underground base. There are abductions by ETs with human military personnel present, or the being handed over by ETs to military personnel. There's abductions by human military where it's predominantly human experience, but there may be ETs present. So those are two, you know, variations on the same thing. One is you're taken by humans, one is you're taken by ETs. Then there can be abductions by humans only without any ETs present. So it may involve no ETs whatsoever. But how you know it's related to your ET experience is they're questioning you about, there's usually an interrogation process. That interrogation is usually about agenda and alien agenda and alien motives, or about alien technology. It's, or they're doing exploratory surgery or medical procedure on you as a follow-up to something the ETs did to you. In other words, it's very clear to the abductee it's because of the ET experience that they're having the military experience. The covert ops, I should say. See, even I fall into
it's tough, pattern. It's tough, yeah.
It's tough, yeah. Then there's mind control procedures, intimidation, fear inducement, hypnosis, and lots of drugs administered throughout the procedures or events. There's in-depth interrogations and debriefings. You can be roughed up or physically abused. There's medical and genetic procedures, everything from exploratory surgery. In alien abduction, most people are probably familiar with the missing fetus syndrome. Some abductees are aware that they're pregnant, and then they have an alien abduction. They're suddenly not pregnant. They may recall a fetus being removed. This is fairly common. This has also happened in these experiences, where they feel that the covert ops were involved in this way, in the removing of either tissue or a possible fetus. Cloning experiments can be seen. A lot of abductees report that they either feel they were used in some kind of cloning thing, or they saw cloned beings. Certainly seeing hybrids, while that is extremely common in alien abduction, it's also fairly common in these experiences. Not that much, but again, I know of some cases where they've claimed to have seen hybrids or cloning of some type. Then there's implants being removed or inserted by humans. This is where you have an ET implant. You know, of course, you can, for instance, you can go to see Dr. Roger Lear or another surgeon and have it surgically removed, fully conscious and of your own choice. But some abductees feel that they've been picked up by the covert ops and that the covert ops has removed their ET implant. In one case, I know of someone who feels that the covert ops removed an ET implant and turned around and put in one of their own, put in a human one. So that kind of thing. I know of a couple cases of people who say they had ET implants removed in their military abduction experiences. There's testing and demonstration of psychic and paranormal abilities that the covert ops guys are very interested in. Do you demonstrate any paranormal or psychic activities? Can you manipulate matter with your mind? Can you read thoughts, do telepathy, psychokinesis? Do you remote view? You know, those kinds of things come up a lot. People are often tested for those abilities. And then there's the involvement by intelligence people in the personal life of the abductee. This can be where you're befriended by intelligence personnel, and or people that you later learn are intelligence personnel, or you believe are insiders. You believe that they're somehow connected to programs that develop some of this technology, that maybe deal with something regarding the ETs or the cover-up or intelligence, like I said, or engineering people, but you have reason to believe that they're insiders, that they're truly insiders, meaning that they're involved with the subject in some way, mostly in some professional capacity. And then you can be befriended by these people and have them glom onto you, where you meet them in your life, and then they may threaten you, they may warn you, they may encourage you, they may provide you evidence, they may be fishing around for information about your personal experience, they may question you, and sometimes these people are not friendly. Sometimes the abductee is very upset by these people when they meet them, and the people are less than friendly, and sometimes they're very friendly and very helpful, and so it's a combination of that. One abductee coined the term minder, that you have these minders in your life, these people that seem to be monitoring you and keeping tabs on you, and they usually you befriend them, and so that's what we call the minder scenario. And so that's kind of the range of things that happen. That's the checklist.
Now, here's something that always crosses my mind, is that, if I was in that situation and somebody knocked on the door and said, I'm from some national organization and we are very concerned about these issues and we need to ask you some questions. Would you be willing to talk to us? I have a feeling that most anyone would say, like, I will tell you anything you need to know. I would happily help your cause, and then just
yeah. But if they come to an abductee and say we're here asking this because we know you've had involvement with ETs, well, there's a word for that. You know what that word is? That's disclosure. And they're not disclosing. They have no plans to disclose. So, they would approach you like that if they could, but they approach you that way, they would be disclosing that this is real and that this is really happening to you. And they can't do that. But they can do it in these very covert, manipulative ways, and they can have the same effect and get the same information and yet don't have to disclose to you that this is really going on, that your experiences are real, that they know that, that they're involved. Because if they came to your door and knocked, and I mean, just about everyone I've talked to with these experiences said, if they asked me, I'd be willing to talk to them. But then I'm like, yeah, but then you'd be asking questions like, how do you know this? I don't know that my experiences are real. What proof do you have that my experiences are real? This kind of thing. And so it's like, again, that's called disclosure. They would be disclosing to you and you think that abductee isn't going to, like, tell ufology? You don't think they're going to go tell the abduction research community, the person they're working with, a researcher? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they are. Even if they say, I'll talk to you. I won't talk to anybody, sure. Yeah, you will. And then how would they get you not to talk to anyone? Well, they would threaten you to get you not to talk to anyone. But if they threaten you, then they're doing an illegal activity, so they can't do that. But when they take you covertly, they can threaten you. In fact, they have carte blanche to do whatever because they have, what's the magic two-word phrase everyone in ufology should know? Plausible deniability. Plausible deniability by doing it exactly how they're doing it.
And as well as just how absurdly paranoid and it sounds when someone says, my phone's being tapped by the secret government, and so it's because of my UFO abduction experiences that they're abducting me.
Yeah.
I mean, that is,
plausible deniability.
Yeah.
You bet it.
That person is going to be not going to be taken seriously.
Yeah. And up until recently, they haven't always been taken that seriously even by ufology.
Yeah.
Thank God that's changing. But yeah. Yeah, exactly. So there's so much that they risk by approaching an abductee in a way. Now, they do approach some. They have come to some people's doors and stuff, but it's been more confrontational and warning kind of thing. It's not like we need your help with this. Now, there is one situation where they do say, we want your help, we need your help with this program. It's a matter of national security. You're doing your country a favor. There's one situation where they do that. And that's what I call my military on military cases. There are abductees who've joined the military, like anybody else. You know, you're in the military, you just happen to be an abductee. There's seemingly no relationship between the two things. Some abductees who have served in the military while in the military have covert ops stuff happen while in the military. Some of it, like how I'm already talking about this, as far as they may take you, drug you, the period of missing time, you know, it's against your will, they try to erase your memory of it. Some of it is like that, even though they're in the military. Some of these individuals get approached and get incorporated into some kind of program or activity, and where they are asked, like the scenario we were just saying, where you're approached and you are asked and you sign some forms to agree, or you know, this kind of thing, and they question you. And then there's a combination again, so it's not all cut and dry one way or the other. There's a combination of stuff. But I am aware of about 12 or 15, I'd have to sit and think about, at least 12, I think about 15 cases that are military on military cases. These are people who've, again, while serving in the military, had these kind of covert op stuff happen, that somehow the military knew that they were an abductee, like they would know that I or anyone else having this stuff happen is an abductee. So I'm not sure that their being in the military was how they knew, but they knew in all the other ways that they could know. But when the person's in the military, you're kind of like, well, you're a easy target. you're a sitting duck, if you will. And so some of these people have been used in various scenarios and events involving ETs and ET technology, sometimes willfully and sometimes against their will. But these covert ops experience that happen while in the military, in many ways, they are using that person because they've had the military training, and it seems that your training comes into play in some way. Some of these scenarios seem just like a matter of convenience. You're there, it's convenient to get you, kind of thing, where they may have had these experiences even if they weren't in the military. It's just that made them a sitting duck. It was convenient. But some of these are definitely being involved in programs, and they, more than a few times, they've been involved in specifically like an ET communication program where the person is in the military, they have a covert abduction while there. Before they know it, they're involved in this situation where they're being put in a situation to have to communicate with ETs.
And how does this happen? Do they just use it telepathically? Do they sit in a chair in the lotus position and just try to communicate, you know, through telepathy?
Yes, usually it is telepathically in some way, and it's because I think the abductees, this is such an I won't say normal, I guess normal and natural, I guess, feels funny to say that, but a normal or natural process to having their ET abductions, that if they've had a lot of ET abduction and they're used to interacting with the aliens, then if you're one of those abductees who's had a lot of that interaction and then you're in the military and they feel that you're someone that can be used in a covert situation to interact with ETs and you're just naturally good at, like, they could stick any other soldier in that room and they're going to freak out, because there's a lot of insiders who've worked with ETs and a lot of insiders who've come out, you may be familiar with some of this, have talked about there being an acclimation process before you're put in with an ET, before you ever see one. You could be involved in a project and it could be months and even years down the road before they put you where you actually see an ET or communicate with one in some way. That apparently there's an acclimation process, that this is difficult for people. They freak out at first.
Yes, there's a profound fear response that people talk about that sounds almost synthetic in a way.
You think about it, it makes sense that if they've got someone, who's an abductee, that they can plug in that same situation there's all no acclimation process needed. They're already acclimated. They've had a bunch of abductions. So you take them in a covert manner. You make it similar to their abduction experience. Before they know it, they're interacting with an ET kind of thing. They're already acclimated. There's no months or years of acclimation process. It's already there. So it, to that degree, it makes sense that they would use that, that they would use abductees in the military for that purpose. And sometimes it's hands-on with the technology. Again, a lot of the abductees are able to interface and work with the technology without the training or the acclimation that would be required for other people. So the military on military cases make sense, but unfortunately they're also some of the most severe cases I have. Some of the people who have the most severe treatment, and I think it's because you being in the military, it usually happens within context of your being on duty. Talk about plausible deniability and built-in cover story. You're already on duty. You're already involved in something, you know. And I think that gives them license to maybe even be a little rougher. You know, they know you can take it. You're military trained, you know. Some of these can be a little bit rougher.
Now I'm just going to chime in. This is my own personal opinion here, I've heard these kind of stories before, and some of the stories that involve back engineering the ET craft as well as underground bases with you know, gray aliens living there, or I'm very suspect of those, and I listen to them. I'm just trying to fit a pattern. I've heard the stories show up, and I just those stories. I'm very cautious to how much I trust those.
But I'm telling you, there's a bunch of these covert ops cases where this is you know, standard operating procedure. I mean, so it's like it's not unusual in the context of these covert ops cases to see, you know, grays and humans interacting, to see or at least present in the same environment, even if they're not interacting. Advanced technology that the abductee said, I saw this craft, I saw this weapon, I saw this plasma thing, I saw this doorway thing, I saw this vehicle thing, I saw this craft like this, this other craft this way, and this other ship like this. And then I get them to try to tell me, well, is that ours? Is that human technology? Or is it the ETs? And, you know, usually the abductee says, well, you know, I don't know. I mean, it seems pretty advanced. I don't think it's ours. Or if it's ours, we reversed engineered it. And or sometimes the abductee is very clear that, oh, no, this is ET what I'm looking at. But, you know, quite often they're not certain, but they're describing stuff that they sometimes, you know, again, sometimes the abductee says, this is ours. Sometimes the abductee will say, no, it's theirs. And sometimes they'll say, you know, well, I think it's ET, but they must have given it to us because these are humans operating it, you know, that kind of thing. So, or sometimes they see an ET operating it. They're like, no, this is ET, and there's an ET operating it, and the humans don't have a clue. So I have all these kinds of things reported to me from these experiences.
Yeah, I very much trust that you have those things reported, and this is one of these things where maybe it's just my being stubborn in a way, just to be so reticent to trust completely those stories. You know, there's such potential for mind control or something.
The mind control that really comes up in my research, and initially I kind of was kicking and screaming about looking at it, because I thought it could be said to, you know, when you start explaining as mind control, you discredit so much of the experience and stuff. But as time has gone by, I've really become pretty clear on how mind control is a factor in it. Now, it is a factor in it in that it is used to cover up the abductee's memory, the use of fear, drugs, hypnosis, and intimidation used together, where they induce fear, drug the person, they use hypnosis on the person. You know, this kind of stuff is used extensively to either control the abductee in the experience or to get the abductee to forget the experience or repress, not even so much forget, but repress that the experience happened. So, yes, those kind of mind control techniques are used. I have not really found a big use in that they're being mind controlled to create a completely false experience of some kind. The abductee is usually pretty clear, and I'm usually dealing with people that have pretty good memory or have recovered memory of what has happened, and they're usually fairly clear about it. There is the drugging and the hypnosis and stuff done, but it doesn't seem to be, again, where people are recalling its usage in the experience, it's not to induce a completely fake experience. It's to get a deeper level of information from the abductee, to take them into a deeper state where more information is retrieved, or to specifically, again, used in techniques to repress the memory of the abductee. And in those ways, it comes up a lot. But I have not really had it come up where they're inducing a fake thing. Because when the abductee recalls what's said, what happens, there are these real clear, specific patterns to the things being said by, those administering the drugs and doing the hypnosis and stuff, that it's pretty cut and dry, as far as the types of procedures used. And I'm seeing a repetition of certain procedures and things that again, all seem to be focused on repressing the memory or getting to a deeper level of information and not, the only times when there's been some times, because it's coming to mind right now, a couple of cases I've heard and people I've heard from or talked to that have said, well, they told me they didn't want me to remember this. They wanted me to remember this other thing instead. And so then they did act out a little scene in front of me, or they gave me some images or something to look at, and they said, this is what we want you to remember. So in those cases, yes, they were trying to get them to remember something false. But it was in bits and pieces, and the abductee knew what it was. And they were like, no, they knew it wasn't right, kind of thing. So there have been some things like that reported to me. I can't say it's not happening at all. It may be, but I'm seeing so many like consistencies and patterns and verbiage and activities that, that I think if something really didn't fit, I would know it,
Yeah, you're an excellent advocate for this line of inquiry, and your research is very compelling. And I just wanted to state that, this is an avenue that I'm, every time I hear this stuff, I make sure to be very cautious to how...
That's smart. I mean, that's smart. You should be...
Skeptical for, I'm being skeptical because the claims are...
Oh, yeah, no, I think healthy skepticism is necessary. I think it's necessary in all things in life. People need to be more skeptical of things in their everyday life.
I mean, it very well may be true. And it's just that I on a very big picture, the very big picture level, I have not been fully convinced. I will repeat myself, and your research does it does seem to have a lot of fanatic, or you're not coming at this as a you seem to be using a lot of evidence and citing a lot of things in your own research.
Yeah. I mean, I really make an effort to keep everything very evidence-based. I'm very hesitant to really get into a case where someone doesn't have much evidence. You and I have even discussed this recently on the phone, that there's been some cases you're aware of that I've shied away from because of their lack of evidence. I very much, try to have it be where the cases I look into and the people I spend any amount of time really talking to about their experiences or interviewing them about their experiences, that these are evidence-based cases. First and foremost, I want the person to have evidence for their alien abduction, And I'll talk to anyone, But that's the difference between the cases I interview and I actually cite in my research. And of course, if someone's written a book and the evidence is well talked about in their book, I have no problem talking about what they said in their book if I already feel that their case is well supported by what's presented in that book. So, of course, I'm citing people's books and stuff all the time. But in the cases I've specifically interviewed, I really focus on the cases that have evidence. And I'm very fortunate to have met cases that have very good evidence, like lots of good evidence. And so, you know, so I focus on that. And you know, the day that I write a book about this, you know, only the cases with the really good evidence are going to be included, you know. And when I say really good evidence, I'm like, you know, evidence of a break into your home, multiple photographs of black and video footage of black helicopter harassment, documents they've received, says a lot of witness cases, some really good witness cases, you know, where someone else was involved, someone saw what happened, someone witnessed it. You know, I'm very fortunate to have some very, very good cases.
And then you spoke about like a boot print on a wall, and then
sure. Well, I have lots of.
Tell that story, because
the one you're talking about.
Yeah.
It first off, here's a highly credible abductee. The guy is in law enforcement. I won't get into where or anything, but he's highly placed in law enforcement, and that particular experience, he's in. First off, he's an ET abductee, lots of abduction stuff. And that particular experience, he's home one day and his brother is visiting. So him and his brother are at his house. And I think it's just the two of them. No one else is there. And he goes in to take a shower. And when his brother is sitting and watching TV, he comes out of the shower and there's two guys in military camouflage in the hallway waiting for him when he comes out of the shower. And he has a confrontation with them. He remembers they had something on a cloth and that they put it over his nose and mouth, if my memory is correct. They had some, you know, chloroform or whatever, but something that made him pass out. But before that, or after that, I'm not sure, but at some point the brother sees these guys in the hallway and confronts them and gets into some of a confrontation with him. Next thing they know, or the next part of the story I heard, was the brother comes to laying on the master bed, and he's on his back but spread out, you know, spread eagle on the master bed. And he comes to, and then a period of time later, half hour or more, I forget, but a period of time later, he hears knocking on the sliding glass door of the patio, and standing there in the patio without anything on is his brother, who he had seen passed out and in the arms, I guess, of these guys in the hallway. So the guy comes out of the shower, is confronted by the guys in camouflage who knock him out. Then the other guy comes along, gets in a fight with them. They knock him out. He comes to on the bed. His brother's not there. An hour later or whatever, his brother shows up naked on the patio, locked out, knocking on the sliding glass door, trying to get back in. Now, I laugh, but that's all, you know, very intense experience.
Oh, yeah, I'm just trying to put myself in that position. It would be hard.
The guy who was the brother said, I saw them, and proceeded, you know, they walked through all what they knew had happened, and, you know, and said, where have you been, what happened? And the guy said, I'm not sure, and, you know, this and that. And when he opened the door and let him in, he took him right to the hallway and said, this is where I confronted the guys. And he said one of them was leaning right here. Well, they looked where the one guy was leaning against the, like leaning on with his back against the wall, but like it's natural to prop a foot up, right? He had a foot propped up, and his boot had made a mark on the wall, like a boot print on the wall. Now, I have a photo of this boot print. I can't prove it's a boot, per se. Maybe I'd have to do a lot of research, but it looks like a boot, and I can't prove who made it, but there is a boot print on the wall, and my case claims that they took the photos of this after his brother pointed it out to him. And so that's that. And he had some other good photographic evidence of some other experiences, some bruising and needle marks, and then some stuff from his abductions, like a brand new, fresh, rather large scoop mark after an ET experience. So he's a good evidence case. He's bothered to document his experiences. He has witnesses to some of his experiences. He's had a lot of ET abduction stuff, and he's had quite a few of the covert ops things. And and he's in law enforcement, highly placed. So this is an extremely credible witness.
Yeah, I hear these stories, and I think to myself, you know, like, I just, there's just so much potential for humans to be fallible, and for someone on one of these in the camouflage uniform that's in the hallway to make a mistake, and someone ends up getting really badly hurt, or someone has an allergic reaction to some drug or something.
You think if these are really, like, in most experiences, these guys seem really well trained, you know, that they're, and they do make mistakes. So, for instance, I know of one case, more than one, but one comes to mind right away of a container for a syringe, and I forget what, you know, but some kind of small medical container that it had a syringe and some stuff in it. Not the syringe, but the container it was in had been left in her home. So after the experience, the next day she finds this thing left, and she remembers seeing the guy set it down on a bookshelf, like, well, you know, to take out the syringe and use it on her or whatever, but he sets this on the bookshelf. The next day she finds the container, and it's marked with the medical company that supplied it. You know, so here you have total hardcore physical evidence left in somebody's environment, you know. So, I mean, granted, that's rare, but they make mistakes. This guy left a boot print on the wall. I'm sure when he leaned against the wall and put up his foot, he didn't think for a second about, you know,
that he's leaving evidence.
Natural,
yeah.
Thing. So there are, you know, a few people have said, you know, there was this fluid on my bed. I remembered them having this stuff they put on me, and some got on the bed. And so they took a picture of the fluid on the bed. And that, you know, so there have been, very rare, but there have been these cases where there's been physical in, you know, stuff to the environment. When I was taken with a fellow researcher and friend of mine, Misha, when her and I were taken together from her apartment, they broke in the front door, and it was this door had just the week before had new weather stripping, had been newly painted, like the landlord had done some touch-up to the weather stripping and some foam trim she had around the door, because I guess they were drafty, so the landlord had applied this foam trim and had repainted it. And this had all happened a week, maybe 2 weeks at the most, before this experience. And so when they did all this damage breaking into the front door to take us, it was clear. We didn't even see it necessarily the next day. It was a couple days later that we realized this was there, but we remembered how it happened. I mean, we knew full well how it happened. The very next day we were just in denial. We either just didn't see it, or we saw it and it didn't register that there had been this damage. But it was actually seen by my friend. She had someone visiting her, and it was like 2 days later, and they're standing in the doorway talking, and someone turns and goes, "What happened to your door?" Like that. And then they realized that it had all this damage to it. And also in that experience, I was on a futon bed in her living room. She was back down a hallway in her master bedroom sleeping. When we were taken, the guys that took us were in camouflage and wearing night vision goggles attached to some helmets, and it's a long story. But at one point, I forgot she had this small glass top coffee table, like it's like four legs sticking up with an oval of glass sitting on top. And I'd forgotten it was there. And at one point in my drugged state, I walked towards a guy that I thought was motioning to me to come towards him. And I tripped over that glass coffee table. And, well, it broke it. And we did find that the next day. I mean, the next day we were aware that something had happened. for sure. And we had all sorts of evidence, and we had bruises on our body and all sorts of things. But I had a lot of bruising. But here was this coffee table. And the next morning, we're looking at this thing going, how did the coffee table get broken? Its leg was broken. It was cracked. It was knocked off its base. And then later I remembered that I had fallen on it, basically. I'd tripped completely over it in the experience. But, you know, that was immediate physical evidence in the environment. So, and then when they did the damage to the door, they obviously didn't care that they left all that damage. They obviously, you know, like you had said earlier, sometimes they do it in a blatant way where they want you to know. It's not about covering their tracks. Now, I think leaving the medical case for the syringe, that was a mistake. And I think the boot print was a mistake. But obviously the damage to the door was like, they needed to get in there. They need to get in there quickly. They didn't care if it left damage. I mean, what am I going to do, go to the police and say someone broke into the apartment? You know, it'd be an unsolved break-in case. The police would be saying what got taken. We did debate going to the police because between the coffee table being broken and the damage to the door and everything, a couple days after the event, we said, you know, maybe we should really go, you know. And it was actually my friend that this happened with didn't want to. I wanted to, but she talked me out of it. So we never went to the police about it. She got very, very frightened by it. And so we didn't, because she thought something else would happen or would get worse or whatever. You know, she just got very frightened, so we didn't do it. But, and I regret, because I could have had a police report back and all that up, but I didn't.
Yeah, that sometimes this stuff slips through, and it's hard to, you know, I know the feeling of like not knowing how much to trust these little clues.
Well, we took lots of photos of the damage and stuff. We had lots of photos of it. In retrospect, I'm remembering we didn't take photos of the coffee table, but we did take photos of the door. So we have photos of the damage to the door, which I always show in my presentations. And it's on my website and all that.
And I will link to your website on the show notes, and I will, and I have right up on the computer right now in front of me, I have the article you wrote called Rehab's Not My Labs.
Yeah.
So, and I will make sure that that's linked. And I will also link, there's an what I consider very good, even though it's about 4 years old now, it's a very good interview between you and Tim Banal on Banal of America.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And in that interview, you talk a lot about your own personal experiences, and I haven't asked you about those in this interview specifically because I felt that was covered pretty well there, and just I felt it was just best to use the time on this, and I'll link to that also.
Well,
but, oh, go on.
Oh, I just going to say for the listener that I've had a 5 for sure and possibly 7. So I've reason to believe I've had about 7 experiences of covert ops involvement. I've worked with cases with less and I've worked with cases with more. So that's pretty many, even amongst the cases that have had more, that's pretty many, even amongst these things, to have it happen that many times. But I believe I've had it happen 7 times. Like I said, 5 I'm fairly real certain of. And times when I was had medical procedures, and one time for specifically medical procedure, another time specifically to be interrogated about alien technology. In fact, they wanted a specific piece of technology. And apparently I'd been given a post-hypnotic suggestion to retain certain information, and so this was apparently, now here's another experience I don't remember, apparently in a previous experience I'd been given some post-hypnotic suggestion to remember this thing, and then apparently in another ET experience I saw it, so then I got picked up again by the covert ops to have that information retrieved. I don't remember the experience at all of when they would have given me the post-hypnotic suggestion to look at this thing, you know. But apparently in the experience I do remember, I was recalling the detail of this piece and drawing it for them and on a piece of paper and stuff. But anyways, it was a really intense experience and very frightening.
Yeah, understandably.
I mean, I had one experience that, if my memory is correct about this, they actually put a gun to my head. So that was pretty darn frightening. That was definitely for the purpose of a threat. And in a weird way, I think it was kind of a training exercise for training some other personnel, that they were demonstrating something on me. And I don't remember a lot about it, but I remember very clearly having a gun to my head. That part I remember. And that was a different experience. Like I said, I think I've had about 7 of them total. And
how are you holding up, just as far as like emotionally?
Well, I'm doing the research. That's how I'm doing it. Being an activist and helping other people, and that's what I can do about it. So that's what I'm doing.
I will add that that is I can relate to that. Anyway, go on.
Yeah. So, that's what I'm doing. It's like I said, it's evidence that I have the ET experiences, and confirmation and validation, and I've talked to so many other people that have been through similar stuff. I'm not alone. You know, so it's, how do you deal with anything traumatic that happens in your life? You know, you either do or you don't, and most people do. So
yeah,
that's it, you know. And then I'm doing something about it. So I've got friends and therapists I can talk to, you know, people in ufology, people in abduction research. I have a tremendous support team and support circle around me. I'm really, really tremendous. And then I've got my cases and their strength. And, you know, sometimes if I ever get bummed about my own experiences, I just have to remember someone I've talked to who's maybe been through something worse and their strength, you know, and that they inspire me, you know. But, you know, it's just, you know, you get on with life because you have to. It's like any other traumatic thing, or, you know, loss of a loved one, or a major accident, or whatever, you know, whatever people go through in their life, you move on because that's how you live life.
Yeah.
You know?
Hey, what have you, any, what's been coming up recently as far as what's new in your research?
Well, as I said, the military on military cases is something that's was kind of always there, but I never really looked at and realized how many cases of it I was aware of. And part of it was over the last 2 years, I came aware of a couple more cases. So suddenly the numbers jumped from a handful to twice as many, you know, so I'm like, oh, you know.
And I feel confident saying that I may have met some folks that would fit that bill. But anyway, go on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there's that, and some of them are well-known people. I mean, I could do some quick name-dropping here. Niara Isley, who spoke with me.
Yep, who I've talked with many times.
Dan Sherman, who wrote Above Black. Larry Warren. In fact, there's about 3 or 4 of the Bentwaters guys that have had this happen. I recently, this last weekend, I was at the Bay Area UFO Expo, of which Colonel Charles Holt, very well known for being one of the participants in the Bentwaters incident, was there. And I had a moment to talk to him, just him and I, for a little while. And he was very guarded at first and very cautious, but he opened up and we had a nice little conversation. And he was basically telling me that like 4 of these guys had absolutely had this kind of stuff happen. And confirmed something I kind of already knew or suspected from knowing a little more about their stories. And I said, well, I suspect based upon this and this, and because they said this and this other person said this, and, you know, I was telling him about it. And he said, oh, no, they absolutely have. So he flat out said, oh, yeah, no, they've been, like, really messed with, and repeatedly. And I said, oh, okay, so I'm not wrong. And he said, no, you're right. And he said, no, I'm telling you, yeah, you know. So here's Charles Holt telling me, yeah, it's absolutely happened to these guys. Not to him, or so he says, not to him, but to some of the other guys.
Wow.
That they were messed with. And I knew that. So there's those guys. John Vasquez, an abductee who wrote a book called Incident at Fort Benning about part of his incidents. Vance Davis, one of the original Gulf Breeze 6, who wrote wrote a book about his experience.
Oh, now the Gulfbreeze 6, those were the folks that left like the base in West Germany and then went all the way
Yeah,
to Gulfbreeze, basically to
exactly.
assassinate poor Ed Walters.
Well, maybe not, but but that they thought they were programmed to go on a mission, and so it's a big deal. But they have this kind of stuff happen. So,
Before the event where they went to I've always been fascinated by that, and I didn't realize there was a book on this.
yes, yeah, Vance wrote a book called Unbroken Promises about his experience and about the whole thing. And but he had had this happen, and he had more. A lot of times, these guys have more happen than like they talk about in their books. Like Bent Waters, you can all about know about the guys, but not necessarily know about this part. Vance alluded to some of it in his book, but there's actually more. Dan Sherman, he pretty much wrote about it, but there's even more that than he wrote about. James Bartley, another case, he's been kind of public. So I'm throwing out names of people who've been public, and then there's people who haven't been public. But these are the people that have. I'm reminded here, looking at my notes, I have one gentleman who had 2 years of seamless missing time while in the military, used in an ET communication role, but 2 years of seamless missing time. He ended up going through a lot of self-work and hypnosis and work with therapists to recall some of that. So he's pieced, he's pieced some of it together.
Wow.
But so he knows that some, things happen. Of course, he hasn't accounted for 2 years. And all the work I've done, I've probably accounted for 2 days out of 2 years. But just to have that severe of a period, seamless period of missing time of 2 years, just. But I mean, it's I, he's a very legitimate case. Very, very down to earth. Very evidence based, and yeah. And then Niara had 3 months of missing time.
Yes, and I've talked with her about that a little bit.
And I have another case that had 3 weeks of missing time, as far as military. A lot of the military cases have the more severe periods of missing time. I mean, for most abductees, it's like, whether it's ET or military experience, it can be 1, 2, 3 hours, sometimes 5, 6 hours. But and there's a few cases like Travis, and there's a few that have a couple of days of missing time. But these military cases seem to involve longer periods, like weeks.
Yeah, 2 years is shocking, yeah.
Yeah, really shocking. Yes. At least with Dan Sherman, it seems that he had a lot of most of his involvement was very conscious, and that's just it too. A lot of abductees have very conscious recall of their covert ops experiences, more so than their ET ones. That's one thing that stuck out early on, is these memories tended to be more conscious. And yes, there's some people needed hypnosis for it too, of course, or hypnosis to fill in parts that were missing. But right away, they're always quick to tell me, besides always quick to tell me that, the covert ops experiences are always worse than my ET, the other thing they're always quick to tell me without my hang to ask is, I remembered this consciously, or I remembered parts of this consciously, or, So that's also a very common thing, that they remember it consciously. And I think it's because it's human, there's so many, it's less otherworldly, it's more recognizable, but that also makes it hard to deal with. So on one hand, it's like, oh, this is really, this is real as my remembering what I did for lunch yesterday, but at the same time, it's like, that also makes it more in your face and makes it harder to deal with, because it's, you can't push it away.
Yeah, and it's your, it's us in the sense, it's and I could see that being really hard. And the folks I've talked to that claim this experience, in essence, say exactly that they feel very violated. And I know
Yes.
that, and some of the folks that I've talked to, there's some it seems like sex is being used as a way to control or a way to
Oh, yeah.
manipulate the
I mean,
situation.
a way to disempower somebody and and intimidate them or cause fear, particularly with women, both men too, but particularly with women, is a rape scenario. So that's often a part of it, because you can disempower someone, get them very fearful, you know, pretty much shut them off completely, you know, by that. And so luckily, though, you know, you're hearing of those cases, but luckily it's not like, it's not all of them by any means. Some of the cases don't have that kind of thing at all. But there are times that it does. So it has been used sometimes. But I don't want people to think that all the MyLab cases involve that. Not at all. Not at all.
It just makes my heart sink to think that there are, you know, folks out there, and they must obviously have a little an instruction manual, you know, on how an effective way to manipulate
it's
people.
It's the same kind of, you know, justification. The ends justify the means of how to get information, how to interrogate, how to disempower another person. You know, it's the same line of thinking that allowed for the atrocities at Guantanamo.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same thing. And you think, well, those people were treated that way and they felt that was being justified. Well, same thing here. You know, it doesn't make either of them right, but it is, you know, it's part of the method for doing that, and some abuse of power, just like a Guantanamo, where that we realized some people were abusing it. You get some sick individuals in an environment that gives them permission to be sick, and watch out.
Yeah.
And so you have some of that going on here. That same case with the boot print on the wall, he had another experience. The same gentleman had another experience of going through an interrogation, and there were some guards present, but one guard in particular was being very belligerent and really rough on him. You know, this guy was just being, the other guys were more like doing their job and acting like military guys, and here, this, you know, this is my case who's, you know, high place in law enforcement. You know, he's a policeman, basically, but I won't go into more detail, but highly placed, you know, and head guy, you know. And so, you know, when he's being mistreated by these guys, I mean, he knows a trained asshole when he sees one, you know. And he said this guy was really being a jerk and being much rougher and was being unnecessary. And he said, at one point I got so angry, you know, and just, like, told the guy professionally how he was being wrong. And he said, I slipped into, like, a work mode, like this was my subordinate, and saying, you're way out of line, you know. But he told the guy off. He told the guy off, and he said, I got really mad, and I lost it, and I told the guy off. He said, well, they finished their procedure, and they left the room. And he said, I was left in this room by myself and for a few minutes. And he said, all of a sudden, one guy comes back, but it's the guy he had told off. Comes back to the room, punches him in the groin, like swings and punches him low, but hits him in the groin, and was like waited till like no one was around to come back by himself. And he said, you know, how, you know, like kind of like, how dare you talk to me that way, or how, you know, make me look bad in front of the other guys or whatever it was. You know, I can't remember what he said the words were, but he said the guy was really, you know, PO'd that he made him look bad. You know, he said his whole thing was, I made him look bad, you know. So he said he came in and he said he approached me like he was going to approach me and say something. And he said, I was prepared to, like, even apologize to him or say, you know, he said, I just wanted to diffuse the situation. And he said, all of a sudden, the guy approached me like he was going to be all nice. And then when I least expected it, boom, he punched him down in the groin. Well, my case actually developed a hernia from that, and has the x-ray and the medical report saying he got a hernia as a result of blunt force trauma. Now, of course, he can't prove to the doctor, you know, how he got blunt force trauma. I think he said he roughed house with someone and got kicked or something, you know, he made something up, but he had blunt force trauma and got a hernia from it. But that's just a case of, you know, here you have one guy. The other guys weren't acting this way. This guy was obviously out of line. And so, you know, but you give one asshole that much power, and, you know, so that here you have someone who abused it. And granted, that's nowhere near as bad as some of the rape situations, but, you know, some of those are, if they feel they need to disempower a woman, and if that's the way they can do it, then, you know, and if they're in a situation where maybe they're abusing, or maybe it's part of this procedure, you know, in some cases it seems to be clearly abuse and somebody, and they're out of line. And in some cases it's questionable whether that was a planned part of the procedure to elicit a certain kind of response or put the person in a certain state of mind. Like you were saying, part of the mind control part of it is, you know, to put somebody in a certain state of mind.
Yeah.
And if the rape can help do that. And so in some cases it seems that was a planned procedure as opposed to something unplanned. But there have been a few reported to me that seem to be unplanned, that maybe someone was taking advantage of the situation. You know? But luckily, there's very few of those. I mean, very, very few of those. And even the guy getting punched, that's, usually these guys are handling you like you would expect military personnel to handle a civilian in a situation. You know, yes, did they take you? Is it against your will? Are you being threatened? Or, you know, everyone's told things like, you know, we'll kill you, we'll kill someone you know. People with kids are told, we'll kill your kids. If kids are taken, they're told, we'll kill your parents, you know, this kind of thing. So that kind of stuff just about always happens. There's always a threatening component to it. But it's very rare that an abductee is really mishandled physically. I mean, but they are, you know, they are. It's just, you know.
Yeah. This is the dark stuff to talk about. Hey, there's one, there's an aspect.
Well, it's just the reality of it. It's just, you know, part of, you know, the nature of the experience and the environment and how they're going about what they're doing. And I think it's important, and I think maybe we should talk about that for a minute as far as why they're doing what they're doing, because we're losing sight of that. And for people to say, why is all this happening? Well, that my research is really predominantly about why they're doing this. You know, why these things are happening.
And why do you think they're happening?
Predominantly it falls into four categories. I admit, since I'm a little tired, I'm referring to some notes. Four predominant areas of information they seem to be interested in, based upon, now again, the harassment surveillance stuff, I think, is they're monitoring you, they're watching you, they're trying to figure out if you're somebody worth more of their time, attention, and black ops money, black project money. So I think that they start with, you know, monitoring, surveilling, and some people have just some of that, and then it falls off, and they don't have the reabduction. But at the point that it goes to the reabduction scenario where you may be interrogated and ask questions, that kind of thing, there's predominantly four categories of information that come up consistently in these experiences. One is motives and agenda of the ETs. And that's kind of consistently there, and the few other researchers that have cases of this say that seems to be the predominant line of questioning. What are the aliens' motives? What are the agenda? Why are they here? Why are they doing this to you? Why are there abductions? You know, it's kind of like, and I don't know if that's, I don't really get a feeling, and usually the abductee doesn't get a feeling that the covert ops guys don't know the answer. They're just wanting to see what the abductee knows. So a lot of it's about motives and agenda. And then the next thing is ET and abductee genetics. And so it's a matter of, you know, have you been genetically messed with? What's happened to you genetically? Like I said, the production of hybrids and clones and those things. So that's part of it. The other one is abductee and ET psi abilities. Have you been trained by the ETs to do certain paranormal things? Have your paranormal abilities enhanced? been enhanced? Are you naturally psychic? Again, psychokinesis, remote viewing, you know, do you do these things? Telepathy. And can it be tested? Can it be duplicated? Can you do it on command? That kind of thing. And then last but not least, and the biggest one, well, maybe tying with ET motives and agenda, or second, biggest in my research, I should say, in my cases, this seems to be number one. And some of the other researchers, they say, no, motives and agenda are still number one. But this would be number two, which is ET technology and its operation. So they're questioning the abductee, have you seen technology? Have you operated? Have you had hands-on? Do you know anything about navigation systems, propulsion systems, weaponry, energetic systems? Have you had hands-on? Can you operate it? Have the ETs shown it to you, described it to you, told you how it works? You know, anything along that line. And you know, not only have you seen it, have you handled it? How did you handle it? How were you able to do it? Can you duplicate that? If we hand you a piece of ET technology, can you, do you know how to operate it? You know, that kind of thing. So a lot of that kind of stuff. You know, what do you know about the propulsion systems? Has that been shown to you and described to you, and, you know, that kind of thing. So a lot of interrogations about the technology.
And I have had first-hand encounters with folks who tell me exactly that, you know, about their own experiences. And one of the women is, and she's very open with her experiences. Her name is Anya Briggs. And I interviewed her, and she tells a story very much like that, where she has to describe a UFO propulsion system to a government agent type character. And it's very interesting, because she says she basically recites things that she had no idea that she was talking algorithms and logarithms and using terms she didn't understand, and she just spouted it right out.
Yeah. That happens. And there may be, whether these guys are just really digging deep and getting into stuff the ETs have told you and shown you that, you know, in your conscious life, you barely remember the abduction, or you may remember being shown technology, but you don't remember a lot of details about it, when really the ETs may have downloaded you, you know, with a bunch of information, have learned just the right use of, like you said, mind control and drugging and hypnosis to access that information. Or, so that's, of course, a likely scenario. And another scenario that could also be there is that the abductee had some other event with these covert ops types and was given a post-hypnotic suggestion to retain certain information, and maybe even given a little bit of technical training in their covert ops experiences, so that they would look for the right kind of thing in their ET experience. There's a lot of things that happen, you know, in the covert ops experiences. There's a lot of like training scenarios and war game scenarios that get related to me.
Yes, and I've heard some of that too. Yeah.
That get related to me, that people have been through, and sometimes the abductee is put in a uniform and made to play soldier. You know, of course, these are even more severe and in depth if it actually is someone in the military that's having the experience. But even for someone not in the military, it's very weird that sometimes they put them through these scenarios. I knew one whole family having this happen, and they talked about these, you know, scenarios where they had to run a course and do this obstacle course, and could they do it within a certain amount of time. But it required using a paranormal ability, because you had to be able to, like, see that a guy was behind this other thing, and so you knew to go run behind this pillar, not that pillar, because the other pillar had a guy behind it or whatever, and they were making them, like, use their paranormal abilities to do it. And then the same, this was the dad telling me about having this happen, and the wife had another thing happen where quite a few people get this, where they're sat at a control panel and they have to operate some kind of computer or control or screen, you know, sometimes they have to operate it with their mind, sometimes there's joysticks and stuff they get to move. You know, this kind of thing. So people report those kind of things. All these kind of things get reported.
And I've heard some of that, you know, much of that also. Yeah. Here's a question.
We're pretty up on this.
Oh yeah. No, I'm I have
No,
been.
it's great though. I'm glad you know
And the
you've
thing
well
is that
read
I'm
on
up
it
on
and
it,
you've
but at the same time I'm just it's obviously it's fascinating, right? Straight up fascinating. But at the same time, it's and I've said it before, this stuff is so strange that
Well,
well, here, let
as
me
I
ask. We covered that a little bit in the beginning. Let me ask one question here.
Sure.
One of the things that's happened to me in my, oh, I don't even know what to call it, research, or just now that I'm sort of in the giant sandbox that we're all playing in, the folks that I've interacted with, I've talked to more than one person who tell me in no uncertain terms that they are an alien human hybrid, and it happened because their parents were somehow involved in the government. And I don't know if you've heard this in your
No,
research.
I haven't had someone. I mean, I've had one or two people speculate, but I haven't had anyone tell me in any kind of convincing way, where they said, I know I'm a hybrid, So, no, I've not had that.
Okay, and I have, and so this is very interesting, and this is where it gets the there's a paranormal aspect to this where, and this is more my own set of experiences where there's a paranormal side to this where it seems like I just get confronted with these patterns. It's almost like I want to be careful how I say this so it doesn't sound too flighty in a way, but where I've been, it seems like there's almost been stage managed meetings between me and people who have very unusual stories, and that is one of the things that shows up in a way that I'm not sure what to make of it, where people
Well,
say like I am.
you may be drawing them to you, and seeking them out to some degree. So it may be a combination of you're subconsciously kind of seeking them out, and you're also energetically drawing them to you, right? That's a possibility.
Sure.
And in an attempt to answer your own questions about your own experiences, and just a desire for knowledge about it or whatever. There could be a variety of, factors at play. But regardless, it seems you're drawing it to you. I mean, I do get people telling me stuff, but I've not really had, again, I've not had anyone say, oh, I'm a hybrid. I mean, people that speculated that said, I wonder if, and, this and that, but no one who's given me a clear storyline about I'm a hybrid and my parents were involved in this program and blah, blah, blah. No. That I've certainly heard of those stories. And, yeah, I've certainly heard of those stories. So I believe those people exist.
Now here, just as far as this is, and this is from my direct set of experiences, where I once again worry that I may sound a little flighty, but it just seems that somehow something is being stage managed from behind the curtain, and I'm being compelled in ways that I don't quite understand to follow certain paths, and I'm
Well,
just.
and that may be, because that's common for ET abductees to have that feeling. It's very common for ET abductees to say, I'm supposed to do something. And sometimes they don't know what that is. Sometimes they do. Sometimes they're like,
I'm
I'm supposed
laughing
to
because
be
that you're touching
doing
a
this
nerve
or this
there.
kind of research or speaking about this or doing something for the environment or whatever. Some abductees are clear about it. But more often than not, the abductees are like, I'm supposed to be doing something. I don't know what it is. And they do feel directed. They, like you said, stage managed, managed from behind the scenes. That's very common for ET abductees. Very common.
And do you sense that happening in your research?
As far as my doing the research, yeah. And I've even had, now this, I have it on one hand because I'm an ET abductee and I feel a certain amount of direction and stuff happening there, without a doubt. I mean, I even have some recall of some suggestions and stuff in the experiences. So I can't necessarily put my finger exactly on it, but I definitely feel influence in that way. So that makes me, common in that way to other abductees that have that same sensation and feel that they have some path to do, some job to do. That's very common. Everybody has that, or the majority of cases, I should say.
Yeah.
Now, I've also had some influence from in my minder scenarios and being befriended by insiders and not really influence. I can't say I'm doing anything because they want me to or they've told me to. But I've done things that I've then had these weird little, I call them minder moments. And other people with these experiences have related similar things. And everyone laughs when I end up saying, I call them minder moments, like Maalox moments, the commercials.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God, I'm having a Maalox moment. Well, this is times when in life I'll go, oh, my God, I'm having a minder moment. And what will happen is I'll get these weird, I call them atta girls, like, you know, someone punching you like a friend in the shoulder and go, atta girl, you know. And I get these, I call them atta girls. I get these things, and they're from guys, and they're these insiders that tell me, you know, I'm on the right path or they like what I'm doing or they're paying attention. And I get a lot of these, and sometimes they're very strange. How they come up and where they come from, and they'll just come completely out of left field, and they're really strange. And I get these, you know, we're watching you, we're watching what you're doing, you're doing good research, we want you to know you're right, you know, okay, you know.
That's fascinating, and I don't think I've ever heard you say that in any sort of interview before.
I've gotten a lot of these, and from really weird places, and really some highly placed people, researchers. It just, you know, they're very strange. They're very strange. I mean, I don't get them all the time, but I mean, I've had this happen like, oh, I don't know, at least 10 times, you know. I mean, and each time it's just been very strange. And then things like, you know, meeting an insider who explains to you about how the process works. Like, I got a lot of stuff said and explained to me by someone who wanted me to understand how the whole compartmentalization process worked. And then he also kind of confirmed. I get a lot of, like, confirmations of parts of my experience where someone will say, you know, yes, you're right, and this and that. And they'll clue me in because they'll say something about my experience that tells me they've got some inside track piece of information that, you know, how else could they know? You know, and I've gotten a lot of these. I'd really have to sit and think how many, because for many years I just kind of brushed them off, and over the years I've become more and more aware. Where now I'm acutely aware, and you know, there isn't a time, like, especially if I go to a UFO conference, I don't always have it happen, but I almost expect it to happen. Now, this one I just went to last weekend, I can't really think that I had anything like that happen. I didn't have a minder moment, but if one had happened, I wouldn't have been surprised, because I have happened a lot. You know? And it's just the strangest thing how they'll come up, and it'll be, you know. I had a little one in that I had a confirmation, but I don't know that the guy's an insider. So, you know, sometimes they're pretty vague, and I'm one of those people, I try not to be paranoid and assume things. So sometimes if they're vague, I'm like, well, that was interesting. Is that a minder moment? You know, but sometimes they're not vague. They're very specific. And when they're very specific, I just am like, holy cow, like, not this Bay Area UFO Expo, but the last one, I had a very significant one happen. And it really threw me, because it was really heavy duty. Where it came from, who said it, what they said, it was really heavy duty. But I had a full-blown, you know, definite minder moment of someone giving me an atta girl and saying, you know, the people I work with at this and this project for this and this group and this blah 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 are watching you, they know this, they know that, we want you to know, you know, that they told me to come here and give you this message. And I'm like, dang.
Well, that's interesting, because you know, it's the impression I get then is that there's a, you know, fractionalizing in these behind the curtain groups, that some are different agendas.
Well, and you don't know, you know. On one hand, it's like, okay, the one that happened a year ago was a supportive, you know, backing me up kind of thing, and someone saying, okay, you know, you know, and then there's another guy that I'm friends with that I see periodically that was instructing me all about how compartmentalization works. And on one hand, you're like, okay, well, this is all really good and this is really helpful. But you always wonder what the spin is. What's the agenda? What's behind it? Why is this person saying this to me? Why has someone become... Why is this person my friend? You know, you kind of... You know, sometimes I go, you know, I don't have a bunch of degrees. I'm not lettered. I'm not an engineer. You know, why do these people become my friend? sometimes it's like, you know, you don't know what's behind what's telling them to provide you with that information or something. And some of them, sometimes there's the warning ones, and so those are clear. You know, when they're the warning, at least you know what the agenda is. Oh, this is someone who wants me to stop, or is telling me I'll get hurt if I continue. I mean, I've been flat out. I've had my life threatened a couple times. You know, so it's like, but okay, those are, at least you know what the agenda is. The ones that are friendly are the ones that are almost weirder, because it's like, what's going on here?
Absolutely, you know? I can sense that.
Am I, you know, it's like, am I being set up for something? Am I going to be asked to participate in something? You know, and then those things don't happen. Then you're like, okay, was that meant just to be helpful? You know, you're left being very curious as to what the motivation is. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
And in some ways, you know, maybe that's kind of a reverse psychology thing. Maybe that's intimidating in itself. It's just knowing. I mean, when this guy said it to me a year ago, it threw me for a loop, because on one hand, the guy who said it to me said it like he meant it to be very helpful and very affirming, and, you know, what you do is important and we want you to know that. But at the same time, it freaked me out because of the projects and stuff this guy is involved in. And it's like, I'm a matter of discussion amongst these people. This is like really, and I know what I'm, in one hand, it's like validation, confirmation that what I'm doing is real and important. I've got people's attention. And on the other hand, it's, when you get those moments, it's very much like, you know, okay, you know, it's like, oh, I'm really on the radar and I'm really being watched. And what I'm doing is important enough for these guys to have me as a, you know, to send one of their members to a conference specifically to tell me. And actually wasn't there just for that. He was, I don't want to give it away, but he was there also for another mm-hmm. purpose.
But probably to give someone else a message at the conference.
No, he was there in a known way. He was that someone who was expected to be there. But it was so weird when he said, my compadres, you know, these guys I forget what the exact word was, but, you know, these guys I work with on this project, when they saw you were on the schedule, they knew I was going to be here. They knew he was going to be there, and they saw me, and they knew I take that back. He said, we thought you, because I wasn't a speaker that time, a year ago, I wasn't a speaker. And he said, they told me if you were here, you know, to find you, and that was likely you'd be here because you always come. And I'm like, they know I always come. And he said, oh, yeah, we always know all the events you go to. It's like, you know, we knew you'd be there, you know. And he said, and so they told me you would be here. And he said, I've been looking for you all weekend. And this was like later on Sunday. And he said, I've been looking for you all weekend to tell you this. And I'm like, what? I was like, and it came from someone of significance and importance and highly connected, and it was just very bizarre. So, you know, and there's certain people I've gotten them from, I almost expect it, because I know some, when I, like this guy didn't know was that kind of an insider. Maybe that's also what threw me. I didn't know how deeply placed he was. And so it kind of threw me, or I knew he was, but I didn't know it was related to the subject. And the things that he did, I didn't think would ever relate to anything that I do, you know. So that's what threw me. It was given the nature and the seriousness. And he meant well. He meant very well, I could tell. He on a personal level, because I knew this man, had met him before, and so he meant it on a very personal level to be a good thing. But that he was put up to doing this and told to do this and told to relay a couple of messages to me just was like, you know, it's very disconcerting. Yeah, and I've had it happen a bunch. And some of them, like I said, occasionally that comes from guys that I know are insiders, I know are up to no good, you know. And so when I get it from them, I'm like, okay, yeah. It's when you get it from the ones you least expect that it's very strange.
Wow, this is fascinating. Fascinating.
Yeah, but and this happens to other people. I mean, it would be even stranger if I thought it was only me, but I'm constantly hearing from other cases that say, you know, I had this guy come up and talk to me, and he started asking me about this. And like you said, you know, before I knew it, I got in a technical discussion with him, and I didn't even realize I was able to talk technology like that. And, you know, it's almost like, you know, this kind of minder scenario, and sometimes you're befriended by them and it becomes bigger where including some situations. I know you had mentioned something about wanting to ask me about this, but it's just coming to mind right now, where in some situations the person gets romantically involved with one of these individuals.
Yeah, and that takes place in the book The Exiles by Mia Adams.
Yeah.
And then it also is inferred in the book Witnessed by Bud Hopkins.
Yeah, yeah.
And both of those stories I thought were very strange.
And sometimes, now in both of those cases, it was a helpful thing to the abductee. The person was providing them information, maybe offering them some protection. You know, in both those cases, it seemed to be very helpful.
In both those cases, there was a weird sense of like obsession on the part of the man pursuing the woman. In both cases,
yeah.
The woman was the abductee.
So just because they're trying to really make the relationship happen, so you know they kind of go overboard.
And there was the hinting that was given in the Bud Hopkins book was that they had somehow met in an abduction event earlier. I think I'm remembering that right.
Yes, yeah. Well, in one of my cases, it can be a variety of things. In one of my cases, a case of mine, abductee, lots of experiences, really advanced abduction case, definitely having the covert op stuff. All of a sudden, her husband of 7 years, they have children, they have kids. She figures out that her husband has really had an intelligence background all along. And their relationship was breaking up, so they were headed for a divorce. And in this process, she figures out he's really has an intelligence background. At one point, he takes a gun to her and is threatening her about being public about her experiences or mentioning anything about him or anything, and he basically confirms that here, even though she'd been married to this guy and had kids with him and everything, that she was basically his assignment all along, and he said, "I'm to keep you from going public and doing anything about this or doing it." She'd already been public with her ET. That wasn't so much the problem, although he always gave her a bad time about that. In fact, that led partially to the divorce. As she was being public with her ET stuff, started to lead to their having more and more problems. But her take on it was kind of a little more out there, and so that wasn't such a problem. It wasn't really till she got into talking about the covert op stuff and stuff that he became very threatening and put a gun to her head and said, you know, stop talking about this or I'll kill you. And and threatened her life apparently more than once. Actually married to the guy for a period of time. So there are some cases where the person has married the person and it's gotten really, really extreme. I know of a couple others. None of them have been violent. I only had one scenario that I think got romantic. I don't wish to go into any detail about it, but even then it was confirmation and helpful. I have been threatened and warned, but no one ever acted out in any violence towards me ever. You know, it was just words, you know. And the majority of them have been the helpful, validating kind. You know, but very weird.
Yes, this whole thing is very, I mean, everything about this, the alien abduction thing is very strange.
That's more intense. That's not all covert ops cases by any means. You know, that's kind of the more much more down the road to have that kind of stuff happen. But you know, it definitely happens, and the minder scenarios. Like I said, even it was Angela Thompson Smith who wrote in Diary of an Abduction about the minder scenario, and so she was the one that coined that term and talked all about these intelligence types people interacting in her life, and I had, you know, I knew that I had these people in my life, and I'd heard it from some of my cases, but it wasn't until she wrote about it that I went, oh, there we go, you know, to really give it a name and say what it was. And now I've just heard it from so many cases. It can be really low grade. It can be, you know, just someone just starts to befriend you. It could be, often it can be a guy to another guy, you know, some, mm-hmm. you know, some male abductee, you know, meets someone with an intelligence background who starts telling them about their own personal involvement and sometimes the abductee is usually they're well into a relationship before they realize that it had anything to do with their experiences, you know. Often the abductee realizes it, you know, like I said, really far down the road, and is realizing, oh my God, I've been telling this person all this stuff about my experience, or this person has recommended I do or don't do certain things in ufology, and, you know, I was influenced to go public because this person, or I never went public because this person influenced me away from doing that, you know. It's pretty rare that the abductee sees it when it's coming. Mm-hmm. Some abductees do. Or once it happens once, then they see it, and then they become hyper aware of it happening. Like me, it took me a while to realize what was going on with some of these individuals, and now I see it a mile away.
Yeah.
And now it's just weird, because I'm like, whoa, my lab moment. I'm having a my lab moment. Your stomach kind of churns, and you kind of get that queasy feeling of, oh, God.
And here I'll wind this down now. It seems like this has been going on a long time, and I think content was excellent. But what's...
Long, long interview.
Yeah, I didn't expect it to go this long. It's just these things have a life of their own. And what's in the future for you, in the short term?
Oh, gosh. I don't have anything really planned at this point. Of course, I always am doing new research and meeting new cases and talking to cases I'm already working with, and that's always moving forward. And I'll be attending the International UFO Congress, now being put on by Open Minds.
Mm-hmm. And I probably will be too, and I'll see you there.
Yeah, I'll be attending that. And that's kind of all I've got going on right now. I'm always working on the research, but occasionally it takes a little bit of a backseat to having to deal with life stuff.
Yeah, and yeah, it's hard to make a. There's no way to make a living doing this.
Well,
thank you so much for this. Anything you want to add?
Yeah, another thing about why it's happening is kind of taking this full circle to what I think I was saying in the very beginning about. It's about the fact that they're reverse engineering the abductees, just like they pick up a crash retrieval, you know, downed craft, whether shot down, brought down, dropped down, however it came down, by the aliens or by us, whatever, you know. But however they get one, they reverse engineer craft to develop the technology and gather the information they can. Just like they gather and reverse engineer craft, they gather and reverse engineer abductees. And for the same reason, for information about the ETs and about the technology and management of these subjects. And so they realized at some point abductees were another source of data, and they started data mining the abductees for information. These covert ops experiences, I have cases that go back into the 40s and 50s. So, and everyone's always so quick to say ET abductions started with, you know, whatever, Bang Byron Hill in 1961 or whatever. No. No. There's clearly cases and many, many regressions and many cases that abduction researchers have worked with taking abductions clearly way back. In fact, there's a new book, I understand, by Jacques Vallée, Reentering the Field, and he talks about in this new book that abductions go back into like prehistory, that they go back to, you know, to the 1800s, 1700s, you know, all the way back through the Renaissance, through, you know, he talks about this has actually been going on for a long time, and I think he's probably right. Say definitively that the covert ops involvement, I clearly have cases of covert ops involvement going back to late 40s and this, or the 50s for sure. So it's been going on for a while. It's nothing new, and again, I get back to the main purpose is that they're using the abductees as another source of information and trying to maintain some kind of control over the abduction subject, along with the other control, and maintenance of the whole subject and the management of the whole ET UFO subject. So that's why they're interested in the abductees. And they have a big interest in the abductees because of how many abductees there are. The numbers are much more than anybody out there realizes, even most people in ufology. The current numbers suggest, I'm actually going to flip to a note so I get my numbers straight here. Well, there was a Roper poll done that suggests about 4 million people in the continental U.S. alone. But there's further research that suggests it may be as much as 10% of the world population. And if it's 10% of the world population, that would be 10% would be 680 million people throughout the world. And that's supposed to be based upon a current number.
Yeah, and those numbers, it's very hard to know exactly how those extrapolate. But what we do come up with is that there are a lot.
And in other words, the bottom line is there's a lot more alien abductions than most people realize. And so alien abductions became a matter of national security based on the numbers. And then they became a matter of data for the technology programs and for the ET management programs. And that's it.
Excellent. Good. This went great. I'm a little bit overwhelmed and kind of and thanks
welcome
so much.
Welcome to my research.
Well, yeah. I mean, yeah. It was welcome to my.
I'm overwhelmed too.
Yeah. It's an overwhelming thing. So,
you should leave all that on.
Yeah. Oh, I will. I'm all for the banter. So, great. Well, thank you so much. And I will also say that your research is. I mean, it's very interesting on a lot of levels, and then it's very illuminating, in the sense that you make a persuasive case.
It's another piece of the puzzle that helps people understand the cover up, how the information's maintained, the reality of abductions, where abductions fit in the whole big picture. You know, I just think it's such an important piece. I mean, just that this is happening, it is an important piece. And all my job is to try to articulate that and to have people realize that.
Yeah. Yes.
But thank you.
Yes. Good. Well, I'll keep you updated, and thank you so much for your time.
Oh, sure. You're welcome.
Good. And also thanks for the conversations the last couple of nights, too. Those were also very
important. Sure. No, more. Yeah. And anytime you have any, you know, questions about your own experiences or whatever, don't hesitate to call.
I'm not shy about that kind of thing. So.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Sure, you're welcome. Okay, great. Well, thanks. I had fun.
Great. Bye now.
Bye bye.
Phew. Okay, that was 2.5 hours of very interesting content, and if you found that informative, I very strongly recommend digging through some of the links I put on the show notes, simply to better educate yourself on this very strange subject. And I consider Melinda a very profound resource in this vital corner of the UFO abduction phenomenon. If you've made it this far, thanks for listening. Bye-bye.